Hello, tech fans, and welcome into the latest Tech Sideline podcast. I'm your host, Will Stewart, the founder and general manager of Tech Sideline. Our regular host, Evan Hughes, is still out on Christmas break, and he cannot get back soon enough. This hosting gig is hard. I have to actually prepare.
Yeah.
Like, so last night I couldn't sleep because I was thinking about today's show, and I had to get up early and prepare. So this kind of stinks. It's not like you just get up from the chair and walk over and talk like when Evan's here. I actually have to prepare for this stuff. So Evan, hurry up and get back.
Yeah.
This is episode 107 of the TSL podcast, and we're recording on the morning of Thursday, January 9th, 2020. Whether you're watching live on Facebook or listening or watching archived on SoundCloud, Facebook, or YouTube, or anywhere else you access the TSL podcast, we're glad to have you with us. As usual, I've got with me today on set TSL managing editor Chris Coleman, and behind the scenes, we've got producer Malcolm Stewart. And today, we have a special guest on set, TSL podcast sponsor Jonathan Fisher of the Fisher Law Firm. And Jonathan actually sponsors the whole site. He's been a sponsor for many years, going way back to 2014 when I had slightly fewer gray hairs. So we appreciate Jonathan. And I know what some of you are thinking. If you've seen the movie Wayne's World, when Noah Vanderhoff was on the Wayne's World show. Yeah. First of all, I will not be making Jonathan say funny things, and he will not be rapping about the Fisher Law Firm. And there will be nothing crude written on the back of my show notes. So it's not going to go like that. So we're going to talk Hokie football with Jonathan. And of course, we're also going to talk about his business because he's a TSL sponsor. And we're going to go back and forth between the two. Jonathan's a 1998 Virginia Tech grad. So we'll get into some of the stuff that... some of the Hokie football when he was a student here and afterwards after he went to law school. So most of our discussion is going to center around mid-90s Hokies football. And for those of you who are fans back then, it'll be a fun walk down memory lane. I don't know how much Chris Coleman remembers.
Oh, actually, I remember some things back then better than I do some things from this past season. Impressionable age.
So Jonathan started school in 94, right? Because you were a 98 graduate. How old were you in the 1994 football season, Chris?
Would have been 11.
Good stuff. And
were you a Hokie at that time? You like Hokie family and stuff?
Yeah. Okay. Came to my first game that I remember coming to was the Maryland game in 93.
Man, we talked about it before. That was a good one. Yeah.
Well, what I remember about that game was Maryland's quarterback was Scott Milanovic, and he was also their punter.
So unusual.
You were expecting, you know, a shootout. It's funny, like I can't even remember who plays quarterback for Duke this season.
Right.
But I remember Scott Milanovic.
And he threw for a lot of yards.
Yeah, they had a big time offense.
Let's not go down that path, though. Yeah. So, Jonathan, where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Fairlawn.
In Fairlawn.
About 25 minutes from here.
And did you go to Pulaski County High School?
I did. I went to Pulaski County.
Back in the glory days of Pulaski.
That's true. I was there during 93. Still the best football team that's ever been in this part of the state, period. We didn't win the state, but we were good.
So, you know, I was talking to my cousin the other day. Let's see. He would have been before your time. He said that the current Pulaski County High School has half as many students in it as it did when he graduated in probably 85 or so. Do you remember how many students were there when you were there?
It was just less than 400 in my graduating class. Yeah. So it would have been, you know, 1,300, 1,400 or something like that, I suppose.
So about the size it is now, right?
Yeah, it's smaller now, a little smaller. We were still, when we won the state in 92, we were Division VI. We were top.
Top level.
And now we're basically, you know, with Blacksburg in that size range.
So you were at Pulaski. Was Shane Graham there when you were there?
Right. Shane's a couple years behind me. He was on the team that won the state. He was a freshman year.
They brought him in late that season, promoted him from like JV to varsity, right?
Pretty much, out of need, I think.
And he kicked the game-winning field goal in the playoffs, right?
Up at Robinson. That's the one football game that I've ever been to where I was so cold that I did not care if we won. I just wanted to get back in the car.
Out of here.
But up at Robinson High School.
It's hilarious. If you see like highlights of Shane kicking the game-winning field goal and the team celebrating with him, he looks like a little kid.
Yeah.
Oh, he was a little kid. It's so funny because my uncle did the videos for the teams back then. He was a video teacher there at the high school, and he did that as well. And the year Shane was a freshman, I mean, he was just like a little redheaded nerd. And it showed like the bus, it's like, you know, all the cool guys are in the back and all this, and the coaches are in the front, except Shane Graham was in the front seat by himself, redheaded kid, you know.
So he was pretty popular. After so that game-winning kick, I think that was not in the championship,
right? Oh, no, that was the state semifinals against Robinson
High
School.
Yeah, on a frigid cold day, and Shane comes through. I saw him. I moved back down here in 94, so I saw him play. I saw him play in the 94 season, which was his senior season. And I remember watching him mishit a 50-yard field goal and still make it. He kicked it fat.
He was great, especially kicking off the tee, off the box or whatever they do in high school then.
Tiny little tee back then that they were allowed to use.
I remember the hype around him. I'm old enough to remember going in that 96 season when he was a true freshman. There was a lot of hype. 96.
Okay. So,
and
so
I just remember thinking, well, gosh, anybody has to be better than Adel Larson.
Yeah, he would. I didn't say that. He would have been. I think he probably graduated in 95. He was a freshman in 92 on that state championship team.
2, 3, 4, 5. So when I moved in here in 94, that was his junior season. That wrong. Okay.
Of course, the game after that, the game after the cold Robinson game was the state championship game that really propelled us into the national ranking and all that. The next year we went down to Richmond and beat handily Ken Oxendine's nationally ranked Thomas Dale team,
right,
in a great game. I mean, he the Ox had a long run in that game.
So the only player I remember other than Shane Graham from that era was a guy named Randy Dunnigan. Is that name ring a bell?
Sure. Randy was my classmate, and you know, he's still very active in the Pulaski County football program.
Pop quiz, where did Randy Dunnigan play college football?
No clue.
West Virginia.
Just like Joel Hicks. Joel Hicks was our coach, was a running back at West Virginia back in the day.
I don't think Tech even recruited Dunnigan.
That's probably right.
But he'd be, for whatever reason, I don't know the story there. This is kind of some of people listening and watching will know this, some won't. What about Michael Porter? He was before your time.
He was
right?
Before me.
But he was
remember
probably
that.
A legend at Pulaski County High School, right?
Yes, a legend in that I think he was the only McDonald's All-American basketball player we ever had. But then also kind of that, because it didn't pan out, you know, everybody kind of, I think he went to St. John's or wherever he went.
And he signed with Tech, then went to JUCO for a couple years.
San Jacinto Junior College.
And then St. John's.
Yeah. He wound up with Boo Somebody at St. John's. Mm. So,
but I remember, I wasn't really following, I mean, I was probably late elementary or early middle school then.
Yeah,
I probably saw a game or something, but I don't.
He was supposedly just an amazing high school basketball player.
That's what I hear.
All right. So let's see here. So you grew up in Fairlawn, went to Pulaski County High School, went to Virginia Tech in fall of '94.
Correct.
And what did you study?
I'm a casualty of the engineering program. So I think what it was is that I really wanted to come to Virginia Tech. Mm-hmm. And so I justified that choice by going into the engineering program. You know, I probably would have gone to William & Mary.
So spur of the moment thing?
Yeah, no. I mean, you know, I really wanted to justify that decision, but I didn't really want to be an engineer. I just wanted an excuse to come to Virginia Tech. And then once I got here, I realized that I'd had enough math. And, you know, I would hear people talking about their differential equations.
Diffie-Hughes.
Where the class average was like 8 on a test or something. And I'm like, no thanks. I've had enough math.
So I did engineering. I got my degree in electrical engineering. And I don't brag a lot about many things, but I like to brag about the fact that when I was a freshman, I had 8 a.m. 5-hour calculus, and I got an A. Nailed it.
That's pretty good, man.
Well, I went to Albemarle High School in Charlottesville, and turns out the math prep coming out of there was outstanding. I took calculus my junior year in high school, and my senior year in high school, I actually went over to UVA for math. So
nice.
I came out of there with a really good math background, so I did not get scared off when I went into engineering.
Well, I was good at math. I just didn't like it anymore. So I ended up in history, and then
just like Chris Coleman, he's got a degree in history.
Yep. And then
like most history majors, they end up doing something that has nothing to do with history.
That's right.
Yeah. Wow.
That's right.
Yeah. So you got out. You graduated in '98. You're okay with telling people who you are on the message boards, right?
Absolutely.
He's VPI 98 on the message boards. He kind of gives it away because his avatar is the Fisher Law Firm logo. So you got out in '98, and then what?
Well, I made a decision that I was going to choose between either pursuing a graduate degree in history, which, you know, I considered, or going to law school. But what really, I really wanted to come home ultimately and live here in the Valley.
Stay around this area.
And Virginia Tech Athletics was a big part of that. You know, I enjoy that. I enjoy being around Tech and both just being here and the athletic part of it and going to events. And I knew that, one, going into a PhD program in history is a whole lot of work. And also, it's very, very competitive. You know, you got to be willing to, you know, take a job in Wyoming Community College or whatever in order to get employed. And I knew that it was very likely I'd never find my way back if I wanted to go into that. And
not that Wyoming's a bad place.
Not that it's not, but it's hard to go to run down and see, you know, the Tech basketball game or whatever. If you're in Spokane or that's Washington, wherever.
Yeah, it's Washington.
Whatever.
Whatever's in
Cheyenne
Wyoming.
Is what I was thinking about.
Missoula.
So I decided to go to law school because I knew it would give me the opportunity to do what I wanted to, which is come back here. I never really wanted to go to a big law firm or anything. The plan was to open my own practice, and I was actually the only person in my law school class who did that immediately out of law school.
See, I call that being portable, getting that degree where you can pretty much go anywhere. And you're talking about making career decisions on wanting to be in this area and wanting to continue to be around Virginia Tech.
Sure.
And, you know, I just don't know that many students these days make that kind of decision. For me, when I was in engineering, I decided not to co-op because co-oping meant back then that you had to take every other semester off. And I didn't co-op, which is great for your career, but I didn't want to co-op because I didn't want to miss any Tech football or basketball games.
Hey, man, I admit, you know, similar things.
So we're making career decisions based on missing Hokie football and basketball.
I'm not sure if that's too smart, but anyway, it worked out all right.
It worked out okay. I wound up actually working in the field.
I'm jealous, by the way. I wish I had your job. Well, maybe not.
Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. It's like any other job. There's some, like hosting the podcast kind of sucks. You know, it's kind of hard, but there are other parts of our job that are pretty cool. So a couple things. Let's dig back into Hokie football. And I took a bunch of notes for this. And I want to ask you about here is a question for people on Facebook and for you two guys, see if you can get it right away. What event happened early in the 1994 season that would become a staple of Hokie football for many years and which Frank Beamer would later credit for helping build the program? What happened early in the 94 season that would be part of Tech football for many years and Frank would credit with helping grow the program?
94?
So think about that.
Oh, I know that.
Yeah. So let's see if anybody on Facebook can answer. Do you think you know what it is?
I think so.
We'll give the people on Facebook some time.
Yeah.
So one game I want to talk about, unfortunately, it's an unpleasant memory because I have a story to tell, and it's all about me here. 1994 UVA game.
Is that the tangerines running around?
That
the field
is
game?
The tangerines with maroon helmets running around on the field.
Oh, yeah.
Did you go to that one, Chris?
No.
That was miserable. That was when the Gary Tranquil experiment bore tremendous fruit, finally.
Yeah. Yeah.
How many turnovers did Maurice have in that game?
Five or six.
I believe he had five. I think it was four interceptions and a fumble. And so the story I want to tell about that game is, you know, Tech, as Jonathan pointed out, Tech wore they wore orange jerseys and orange pants. There was a lot of orange in Tech football that year. The weird thing is I don't think Oregon had gotten wound up yet with all their different uniforms. And Virginia Tech that year, you go back and Clark Ruhlin's probably got this stuff archived somewhere in uniform history or something. You go back in that era and there's a lot of orange pants, a lot of orange jerseys, a lot of white pants, white jerseys, maroon pants. I think the helmets were maroon, and that was the only thing that was consistent.
It was a game up at BC or something. We did maroon. We did a lot that year. We had white jerseys and orange pants a few times.
I think
once we had maroon tops and orange pants. It's so far back that even Maryland had normal uniforms. We were like the only team that was doing crazy stuff, it seemed like. Right around then.
And I think the UVA game where they were all orange was the only time that year they went all orange. And they got stomped. I don't even remember the score.
It was like 35-20 or something like that. It was not good.
It wasn't even that close. So Frank said after – so here's a story I want to tell. Frank said after that year that that they burned those uniforms.
No, they retired. We didn't wear orange jerseys again until, gosh, I want to say it was that 2009 Thursday night game against UNC. Ugh. When it was that ugly shade of orange, and we lost that game too.
Yeah.
We lost that game, then we lost a couple years ago to Duke, what, the 10-7 game or 13-7 game? We wore all 14. Orange. The game that Fuller had three picks, but we still lost.
Because Logan had four interceptions.
Generally, the orange jerseys don't go well, although the UNC game in 2017 went extremely well.
So Frank said they burned those uniforms, and that's the only fib I've ever caught Frank telling, because I was in the equipment room prior to the 97 season with Lester Carlin. I won't say what I was doing there or how I got there, but back in the back of that equipment room, those uniforms were all still hanging there. Now, they never wore them again. No. And the weird thing is, those would have been Russell Athletic uniforms, and we went with starters starting in something like 1996. So I don't know why those uniforms are even still back there, but they were there. I remember seeing some jerseys and pants.
Maybe they want to contain the bad energy in there, not let it out into the universe. Who knows? But
one day we'll have Lester Carlin on the show, and
that would be
answer
entertaining,
that question.
I'm sure.
So back to the trivia question. What happened early? Malcolm, has anybody answered it on Facebook Live? What happened early in the 94 season?
Yeah, there's a couple guesses. We've got beating West Virginia, the lunch pail debut, Enter Sandman for the first time.
No, those are some good guesses. What do you guys think it was?
Which, 94 is what, the Independence Bowl year?
That is the Gator Bowl year where they got beat by Tennessee.
Okay, the Gator Bowl year. So
early in the season in 94.
Yeah, relatively.
That would have been the first win over Miami.
Mm-mm.
No,
that was 95.
That was 95.
94.
What do you think it is?
Thursday night win over West Virginia.
Ding, 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 ding. Virginia Tech's first appearance on Thursday night ESPN football.
And they blew out West Virginia. It was like
34-6.
34-6. And that was really like the only like complete game that Tech played against good competition. That
they
didn't play well later in the season.
Yeah. And see, these conversations always come back around. Ken Oxendine had a long touchdown run in that game.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was there at that one.
He was
a
true freshman that year.
He was a true freshman. He wasn't the feature back, but he got in late in the game, and he busted like a 40 or 50-yard touchdown
run. Okay, I remember that because I remember my math class being canceled. So we could go watch the football game.
So what I remember about that is, you know, that was pre-internet days, and I remember going to a convenience store out in Christiansburg, and USA Today was on the rack, and it had Virginia Tech on the front cover. Now, it wasn't in the middle of the of the newspaper. It was a what's inside piece on the top, and they had a picture of Maurice DeShazo. And Virginia Tech was ranked 12th in the country at that point in time. You know, they were coming off a good 93 season.
Well, yeah, there was plenty of hype because DeShazo had finished third in the country in pass efficiency the year before.
Yeah,
behind who was the Charlie Ward. Behind,
could be, yeah.
Behind Charlie Ward and one other guy. I want to say maybe the BYU quarterback. Or
probably.
Yeah. It was a name you'd recognize. Yeah. So there was a lot of hype around DeShazo. Like, if it was modern social media era, there'd be DeShazo for Heisman talk.
Yeah.
After the numbers he put up in
93. Well, he had 22 touchdowns and 7 interceptions in 1993.
And that translate these days to 40 touchdowns. Probably.
Yeah, the way offenses have changed. I think.
They had a little run and shoot thing going. And, and of course, he had what we didn't know at the time was he had Antonio Freeman, who turned out to be a lot of the reason for Maurice's success. So, Malcolm, what were those guesses again? Enter Sandman, which is incorrect. That was like 99 or 2000.
That was 2000.
2000.
Yeah, it was Enter Sandman, the lunch pail debut, and Dale Kizer got it with beating West Virginia.
Specifically on Thursday night. Yeah, okay, so he was in the neighborhood. The lunch pail debut, Chris, you know this.
That was 95, right?
And was it Rod Sharpless's?
It was his mom or something.
Mom or mother-in-law.
Or mother-in-law. Yeah, I think it might have been his mother-in-law. Gave him a lunch pail, and it
so
was
who's
him that
Jonathan,
introduced.
Who's Rod Sharpless?
Rod Sharpless was...
He was co-defensive coordinator with Bud in 1995.
Yeah. Okay.
So Sharpless's mother-in-law gave him the
lunch pail, and he introduced it to the team. So a lot of people think it was Bud Foster that thought of the lunch pail. No, it was Rod Sharpless, who was only at Virginia Tech for 1 year before committing career suicide by going to Rutgers.
I love that phrase, career suicide.
Yeah.
When was Elmation? I always thought he was the one who brought in this attacking style.
He brought in the defense.
He was 93.
Sharpless who brought in the lunch pail itself.
So Elmation was 93 and 94?
That's correct.
What happened to him? Where did he go?
Everywhere.
He just kept doing his thing.
He's like,
he never stayed anywhere longer than 2 years.
Who's the guy who was the quarterback coach for McNabb and all that and was here for a year? And
Actually, Rodgers was here for...
He was here for a while.
Two, three, four. Rodgers was here for four seasons.
That was probably about as long as he stayed anywhere, because he moved around a fair amount too, didn't he?
So we actually wrote about this the other day. Rodgers was at Syracuse for the McNabb years, so at least 4 years.
He was there 91 through 97 as quarterbacks coach and offensive coordinator. And who was the guy before McNabb?
Now, I remember looking him up. Rodgers was actually all the way through 98. McNabb's last year, 95, okay. 96, okay. 97. 98. But he was there for a while.
And then he was offensive coordinator at Notre Dame. Yeah. Under Bob Davey, I think.
Yeah.
And Davey got fired, and that's when he became available. I think that's how it worked.
Is it fair to say that if he stayed at Syracuse, he would have gotten Vic? Do you think the reason we got Vic is because he went to Notre Dame?
I don't know. I don't think so. See, the party line is that Vic would have gone to Syracuse. Jim Cavanaugh, who recruited Michael Vick, told us. Everybody says that. Michael himself might even think that, but I know that family really well. There was no way he was going that far away from his
mom. And that's Cavanaugh talking.
So Cavanaugh thinks if Vic hadn't picked Tech, he would have picked East Carolina.
Yeah, Cavanaugh was worried about East Carolina.
That shows you how recruiting has changed over the years. Michael Vick was a number three player in the state of Virginia, and Virginia Tech got him over Syracuse and East Carolina. These days, they'd have to beat out Clemson, Penn State, Auburn. Yeah. Every major program on the East Coast for Vic.
And wasn't it the deal? Reiman basically said, look, if you're recruiting Curry, you're not recruiting Michael.
Exactly.
So that narrowed the field quite a bit.
Did we know early on that we were not going to get Curry? I mean, do we just basically, we didn't even try.
Curry was number one player in football and basketball. Number one recruit in the entire country. Originally committed to UVA.
Right.
I don't think Nike wanted him to go to UVA. I think they wanted him to go to UNC and then put on that basketball jersey, man, for branding.
So do you remember that he committed to UVA?
I do.
Yeah. I remember that was on a Thursday night where he and Darnell Hollier and somebody else, I think these guys were all from Hampton High School. UVA was playing Auburn on a Thursday night, back when Thursday night football was a huge thing on ESPN. And those dudes all committed correct me, Facebook Live, if I'm wrong, but they all committed to UVA that night, and that was also the night that UVA announced that Carl Smith had donated $25 million towards a big stadium expansion they were going to do. I remember being scared to death of all that action.
I remember, actually, I guess I was in school the first year UVA expanded their stadium, and I guess that was maybe like 2002 when they expanded it.
I think it was earlier than that. Like 2000.
Maybe it was 2000.
Expanded when we went down there with Vic and beat him. They had expanded.
Okay, okay, okay. So I think I was coming back. I remember where I was. I mean, I remember being on 220. I guess I was riding with my dad back home from a Tech football game where we were listening to the UVA game on the radio, and it might have been the grand opening of their newly expanded stadium. And I'm sitting there thinking, man, that's scary. They're investing that much money into facilities and everything like that. And and I know we beat them last year, and I know we beat them. We're probably going to beat them again this year and everything like that. But it's a scary thought that they're investing that much into their facilities, and now they have a bigger stadium than us. And that was important back then, how big stadiums were.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And
stadium expansion was a relatively new thing, and their plans were really nice.
They were impressive, exactly. And it was right around then that Tech announced plans to expand the south end zone at Lane.
Yeah,
it might have been a little before that. And
here's a piece of trivia that I'm sure you don't know. I got really bored one day.
I don't know. I know a lot of stuff.
Lane Stadium has the 104th largest capacity in the world.
In the world.
So if you look at the top of that list, the number one stadium in the world is in Kim Jong Il's Grand Palace in South Korea or North Korea or whatever. And then after that, it's mostly, it's a lot of SEC stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's mostly American college football makes up most of the top 15.
Yeah, for sure.
Big 10 and SEC.
Tech is like right in the middle as far as capacity for Power 5 conference teams.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have the third biggest stadium in the ACC. But there are so many massive stadiums in the Big Ten and the SEC.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, even on a global scale, most of the big stadiums in the world are American are in the college
SEC.
Football.
Yeah, SEC and Big Ten. Yeah. What about like English Premier League football?
When Tottenham played in Wembley, Wembley would seat 90,000. So when they were played somebody like Manchester United or Liverpool or somebody like that, they would set the Premier League attendance record. But the biggest Premier League stadium is Old Trafford, Manchester United, which seats about 75,000.
Huh.
Tottenham's new stadium seats 62,000. But some of those grounds only seat as little. I think Bournemouth, they've rapidly risen through the ranks from like a fourth division team to Premier League, and their stadium only seats about 15,000.
Huh. I mean, 90, yeah. that put it around 25th probably on that worldwide.
Where'd you see this list? Was this on Wikipedia or something?
I just Wikipedia.
Yeah.
It just listed them in order. Beat for Entertainment and looked it up.
But anyway.
All right, so let's segue back into talking about Jonathan Fisher's business. So tell everybody where you went to law school.
I went to the Penn State Dickinson School of Law. It was the first year, actually. Penn State had just joined the Big Ten, and for academic reasons, they needed a law school. They needed a medical school, more or less. So
really?
They grabbed up Hershey Medical. They associated with Hershey Medical, and then they affiliated with the Dickinson School of Law, which at that point was one of the only few remaining independent law schools in the country. It's some people think it's affiliated with Dickinson College. It's not at all. It's completely separate. But financially, it's tough for a law school or any school to stand alone without the support of a university. And so it was just the right time. Penn State needed it, and I think Dickinson needed it. So, I tell people I went to Penn State because nobody knows where Dickinson is. Unless you're from Pennsylvania, then it's very, very well known, actually. But
So it's not actually on Penn State's campus. It's an hour away.
It's
right?
In Carlisle, Pennsylvania.
Yeah. So is it a Penn State law degree? Is that
it? Is yeah. It is.
But I imagine you have no loyalty or
no.
You weren't even on the campus at Penn State you were at the Penn State.
I've
law
never
school.
Been on the campus there. I guess I'll go when we play. Probably
it'd kind of be like going to Virginia Tech's campus in Northern Virginia or something like that. And
I've always seen law school, grad school as business. It's like business, and but undergrad's where your heart is.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And actually, I'm more or less despise Penn State now because of the difficulties they give us in recruiting. Yeah. I don't like them at all. In fact, usually I root against them actively.
Yeah.
So
My wife is a Penn State grad, and that's kind of tough. Since this is going to wind up on YouTube, I just won't say anything. But she and I did go to a game, and I think I've been to two games at Penn State. One of them was the day Tech lost to Temple in 1998, and the jokes will ensue about it's a running joke on the Tech sideline message boards about
how
it didn't happen. But I was there for that, and I remember one of the two games we went to at Penn State. We were walking down the sidewalk, and we were at a break in the sidewalk, and there were some horses, not live horses, but like sawhorse things, blocking access into this road that we were approaching. And a bunch of people came running out and suddenly pulled these things aside. And my wife and I started to walk across the road, and then we had to stop because there was a BMW that was pulling into this road we were getting ready to cross. And so the BMW pulls in and drives right past us, and the guy kind of waves at us. I looked at my wife and said, "Was that Joe Paterno?" She's like, "Yeah, that's Joe Paterno. Dude was just driving himself in before the football game that day." So it was it's always weird when
He didn't go to the game with the team. They go in
he drove like a white bean. That's he was weird. in by himself, and I don't remember exactly where on the campus it was. That was 20, 25 years ago. But it's always weird when you've seen somebody on TV a lot to see them go by you in person, So you get out of Penn State Law School and you come back here, and you said you set up your own shop. Did you know what you wanted to do right away?
I did. I always wanted to have my own practice. I never wanted to, compete for a big firm job or go to a big city or anything like that.
But did you want to prosecute bad guys or what'd you want to do?
I don't think I knew initially. Yeah. I kind of got into criminal defense more by chance than anything else.
Well, there's probably a need for it.
Well, there was. I mean, it's also, I opened my own practice in Dublin, okay? And, I went to Pulaski County and I found a nice spot in Dublin. And I happened to open my practice 1 month after the phone book ads had been placed. So I did not have a Yellow Pages.
Back when the phone book and Yellow Pages were a thing.
For 11 months, I was not I was not advertising the Yellow Pages. So what I did to get work early on is I jumped on a lot of court-appointed lists, criminal court-appointed lists.
Yeah.
I was also doing a little bit of Social Security disability. I did some family law. I did a fair amount of workers' compensation early on. But what I started doing volume-wise was criminal defense. And because of that, I got good at it. The way to distinguish yourself from others in criminal defense, in my opinion, is really to, in these parts anyways, to work hard. So what would happen is, you know, even though, by the way, Virginia on the court-appointed pay scale, I think is still 51st in the country, including Puerto Rico. for example, at the time, when I started, at the time, you would make $100 on a misdemeanor. That's all you can make. The most you can make on any felony at the time, other than murder, other than capital murder, I think was $395. That's total from start to finish, in circuit court. So in other words, maybe it was like $900 on a murder that wasn't a capital murder. So in other words, you could spend literally 50 weeks on a murder trial that wasn't capital murder, which was uncapped, and you would get $900.
Wow. So there was no incentive for a proven lawyer to take cases.
That's right. There are some really good attorneys around here who are still on the court appointed list. I think they do it, frankly, more as a pro bono service almost. And then, you know, there'll be people who if a poor person gets charged with murder or rape or something like that, and it's going to be a high profile case or whatever, they more or less are available to take on that. But it's really more of a public service than they're not making money that way.
Yeah.
But what I did, you know, a lot of people who were doing court appointed work, phoned it in or didn't try as hard as they did. And, you know, I'm running down to the jail and I'm meeting with people, and people in jail don't have anything to do but talk about how bad or good their lawyer is. And so before you know it, grannies start showing up at your office with bags of cash because their kid isn't being paid attention to by their court-appointed lawyer, this and that. So by working hard, I got noticed, and I started getting some retained criminal work. And it really just kind of took off from there. And then after a few years, I kind of happened into traffic defense. It's an interesting story about how that happened. But
we will get to that soon. Yeah. So let's go back into Tech football. So you were there for, because I really want to keep going on that discussion, actually.
Yeah,
I've talked Tech football for 25 years, but not a lot of law. So anyway, let's go to the 90. Let's talk about the 95 season, because you were on campus for that. Mm-hmm. And I do have a trivia question about that also. Now, I think this trivia question is easier. What happened early in the 1995 football season that hasn't happened since then? Don't blurt it out. So we'll ask Facebook Live that. What happened early in the 1995 football season that hasn't happened since then?
That's easy. It was raining. I was.
Yeah, it hasn't rained in a game since then.
Jonathan just gave you another clue. It hasn't rained.
I was at that Cincinnati game too. It was one of two games I went to that year.
Yeah.
And you remember at that point in the season, Tech was 0-2. And it's not like they were an established program like they are these days. They had only been to two bowls in a row. They had finished the 94 season poorly and then lost the first two games of the 95 season. So you're sitting, I remember the conversation back with like my dad, my grandpa, and my uncle was all about Tech will be lucky to win six games this year. Beamer had two good years. Maybe it was just a flash in the pan.
Maybe it's just Mr. Murray's.
Yeah. This Jordan Miller guy's not very good.
My first game as a college student, that was back when, as a student, you could pack into that the old end zone by the scoreboard, you know, and it was kind of open
south
seating.
South end zone.
So me and my dorm mates were basically on the front row of the end zone. I remember talking trash to the BC players before the game, all these pasty redheaded boys talking trash, you know, I remember that. I mean, we had a chance. We were driving there at the end, I know, to try to tie it up. But going away from me, I still remember it. I remember Druckenmiller trying to engineer that drive, and it just not happening. But you're right, we weren't established then, but there was some hype around that season because we had done okay. And certainly the first two games ended up being a surprise, I think, to most people.
And I think Tech probably pretty much brought the whole defense back because that 95 defense
was a bunch of seniors.
bunch of seniors, and then there were some good players left in 96 as well. Mm-hmm. So these guys had all been together in 93 and 94. Oh,
yeah. A lot of those guys were regular players from, like, some of them from 92, but almost all of them were, like, starters in 93 and 94.
Yeah.
It was very experienced.
And so you're right.
It was a good team, as we ended up showing, but you wonder if you squeak out those first two games, does the rest of the season happen? I think we almost needed to be slapped across the head. I remember at the Cincinnati game, I remember seeing Druckenmiller just throw his helmet down in disgust, and I was thinking at the time, hey, maybe he's gonna you know, get this thing going in the right direction. Maybe he's tired of it.
He showed a lot of talent in that BC game, which is also a Thursday night game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Malcolm
opened the season with a loss.
Malcolm has Facebook Live guessed what happened early in that season that hasn't happened since then.
No, yeah, they were real fast.
So Virginia Tech got shut out 16-0, and they have not been shut out since then.
So how does that compare to the Duke loss? Because they're, you know, relatively the same thing. Early in a coach's career,
not as many people paid attention back then. There was no social media back then.
Right.
You know, back then you'd go to a Tech game, there's 40,000 people there.
Yeah.
It's not 60,000 people.
And it was raining that day. It'd be interesting to see what the attendance was.
Yeah. I'd say low to mid 30s. That's
probably,
I guess.
Yeah.
Especially after the loss.
Yeah. And you're right, but the feeling of misery was about the same
as this year's Duke game.
It was similar, but I think it was worse.
Yeah, I don't remember. You know, I mean, I'd go to the game, and then I'd go home, go to school all week. I didn't have internet, so I had no way of, like.
So you couldn't wallow in this pit of misery that did, you know, this echo chamber of misery.
We hadn't really built big expectations at that point, though. Yeah. I mean, it was all early and exciting, but it was, you know, it's different. Disappointing then, but it's different now because, again, I was talking to somebody earlier. It had gotten to the point over the last couple of years here where, especially with, like, the UVA game, where I was much more afraid that we would lose than excited that we might win.
Yeah, I know.
And that's kind of how it is. When you have success as a program, it gets more to that point. Back then, you know, winning was so exciting. Everything was so new. And
we were doing something for the first time, it seemed like, every year.
Yeah.
There was a new high every year.
And that was really fun.
And at this point, the program's accomplished everything it could accomplish except for winning a national championship, right?
Yeah.
So anything we do from now on, we're not going to do for the first time. And that's the downside of building a really good program over time, is you never really get to experience anything for the first time.
So, and so along those lines, the 95 Sugar Bowl down in New Orleans, you know, one of the things I wanted to ask the fans today, and I don't know if we're actually going to be able to get into this, because Malcolm, how many minutes in are we?
38.
All right, we're doing okay. So let's go ahead and ask Facebook, what's your favorite Virginia Tech football game ever? And the reason I ask that now is that mine is the 1995 Sugar Bowl. It was also, and I don't, this may actually play into it. That's the last Virginia Tech football game I saw before I started this website / business. Right. I started Hokie Central in March of 1996. And so every game from the beginning of the 1996 season onward has always has that, I have to go watch it and write about it afterwards. That was not true of the 95 Sugar Bowl. And, of course, we must have taken 30 or 35,000 fans down there. And in the Superdome, I sat on the front row of the upper deck, like some of the best seats I've ever had for a bowl game. It was probably about the 10-yard line, but I could still see everything. And I remember, after Virginia Tech won that game, I remember on my way out of the Superdome just looking around and thinking, you need to take this moment in, because to your point, Chris, this is something Virginia Tech has done. They've done so many things that they'd never done before. They won a bowl game in 86, gone to bowls in a row. And I'm like, it can't get much better than this, except playing for a national championship.
Right. And that was Bowl Alliance back then?
Yes.
Winning one of those big four bowls. I mean, I remember the other teams that were in the bowl games that year. I think think the Fiesta Bowl was like Notre Dame and Florida State. Yeah. The national championship game was Florida and Nebraska. The Rose Bowl was probably USC and Ohio State or somebody like that. I mean, so
and then Texas, and then us. You know,
right, like, right. Yeah. So Tech was those 8 teams in the bowl alliance, and to win one of the, those were the four bowl games that everybody wanted to watch, and to be in one of those games and to win it. I mean, that was huge. And honestly, Tech hasn't won a game that high of a profile game since. They went on to win one BCS game, but that was against Cincinnati in a half-field
Orange Bowl
or Miami Dolphin Stadium, whatever it's called now, Joe Robbie Stadium.
Well, the game was the Orange Bowl.
yeah, exactly, yeah. So Tech hasn't had a win like that since then.
Yeah.
As far as that high of a profile.
That's just my favorite one. And then the next morning, Lee Corso apologized to Virginia Tech fans for saying bad things about Tech. So did you go to that game?
I did.
Yeah. What do you recall about it? I know that's kind of an open-ended question, but
I remember the Texas fans.
They were obnoxious, right?
They were a little bit.
Even after the game, they were obnoxious. Some of them were.
I remember a guy specifically, actually was pretty nice on the way out. He's like, y'all kicked our butts, but still hook 'em horns, you know?
So yeah.
I remember it was cool. I don't remember anything bad. I think they were a little bit in shock at that point. I mean, I think they were going to ride the Texas name to a win. And, you know, and it was that game was just a slap across the face. I mean, we just took it to them there.
I'm sure they were surprised at how physical Tech was.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah. So, Malcolm, are people chiming in yet to say what their favorite Tech football game ever was?
Several.
Yeah. So read some of them off to me.
Jeff Holland, 1995 Sugar Bowl.
Malcolm, do you know who Jeff Holland is? You've been around enough to know who he is, right? What? So you just randomly picked that?
Well, he was the first to comment.
Because Jeff played in that game.
Oh, well, yeah.
Jeff was a defensive tackle.
Okay, I wasn't alive. That's my excuse.
Fair enough. Jeff's always quick to chime in on this stuff. It's hilarious. Jeff would probably also tell you that was the best-looking Virginia Tech football team ever. Mm.
You mean with the helmets off?
No, I mean, yeah, with the helmets off. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Chris Blevins, he says, favorite win since I'm only 19 is the 2015 Ohio State game.
Ah. 2014. Yeah.
I'm going to agree with that. Yeah. Scott McConaghy has the same answer. Matt Bisquette, Georgia Tech game with David Wilson kick return for touchdown.
Really? He likes that one, huh?
That was mentioned twice.
Huh. Interesting.
That was Gary exciting. Lyon, toss up between the 95 UVA game and the 95 Sugar Bowl.
Yeah.
Ronnie Adams, 1999 win at West Virginia.
He must have been there for that one.
Judy McBride, 99 BC game, gateway to the national championship.
Yeah, you know.
That's mine.
Really?
I'm surprised that's a – yeah, absolutely.
A lot of people love that game. For me, it was just I knew Virginia Tech was going to win.
That's why it was my favorite. Like, you knew all week what was going to happen.
You were just showing up for the party.
Well, I was 16 years old, so the anticipation that whole week of going to that
BC,
game.
BC? You mean the BC
game? 99 BC game.
I went to – that was before we had season tickets, like my dad and I or whatever, and we'd come to one or two games every year he would bring me to. That year we picked the UAB game to come to. So we came to the UAB game, and Tech didn't have Vic that day. He was hurt. But they still won easily with Dave Meyer at quarterback. And I looked at the schedule, and I'm just like, I told my dad after that UAB game, and this is when you could buy individual game tickets still after the season started, which you could not do.
Yeah, season tickets were not sold out.
Right. You couldn't do that for a good 15 years after that season. But I told my dad after the UAB game, I said, why don't you buy some tickets to the BC game? Because I think we're going to clinch an undefeated season that night. So he did, and we did. And that's my favorite memory of just – That it's really not just the game itself, but that whole week of anticipation.
Yeah.
Like,
because you're 16, you're living and dying with this.
It still wasn't guaranteed, though. Do you remember after the game, looking at the scoreboard and waiting, and it kept saying, waiting for the Nebraska score?
Well, they reported it incorrectly in the stadium. Nebraska ended up winning that game, but at one point during the celebration, they reported that Colorado won. And the stadium went nuts during the celebration, but Nebraska actually won the game, if I recall correctly.
And did Tech need Nebraska to win?
No, but we were afraid we would get shafted. Called
BCS points, remember?
Yeah.
We were strength afraid of schedule they would pass us, that they would get the chance to play Florida State instead of us, I think.
that Nebraska would get the chance.
Yeah,
so
they were three.
I wasn't worried about it personally,
and I probably wasn't either.
Yeah.
But the thinking among a lot of people in the stadium was that Colorado needed to win.
Well, sure, they if they won,
certain that
yeah
made
that
certain,
made it certain,
no question,
as opposed to maybe like 80-90%.
We all still, I think, had a complex at that point that we were going to get,
for sure,
that we were going to get big time.
Yes,
and rightfully so.
But for me, it was just like, I remember it being like, maybe we get big timed if these are humans making the decision, but this is pure numbers.
The computer's got your back,
right? Yeah, yeah.
All right, so.
Mine would be the UVA game, the game before. In my office, I have a picture of the catch.
The 95 UVA game?
Yes, yeah. That's my favorite that I've attended in person.
So you have a picture of Jermaine Holmes' catch?
Yes, hanging up in my office.
Like, what angle is this? Where'd you get it from? Who took it?
It's the AP. It's the one where the ball's like coming
from
right
the back of the
end
zone.
Yep.
Yeah.
And it's a great picture, and I put it right in front of my desk so I can look at it.
I don't even know if I've ever seen that.
Did you get Jermaine to sign it?
No, I didn't. I'd love to, but
he was working at Tech for a while. I'm not sure where
he was.
I don't know where he is now.
No, but I got it blown up. I actually got the picture. I think I emailed Bill Roth or something at the time, and actually he told me how to get a copy of it. And then I took it to a place here in town, and they blew it up, and it was still nice quality, and it's hanging in my office.
Wow, cool. All right, so you, during that 99 season, you were in law school.
That's
up in
correct.
Carlisle, Pennsylvania.
My second year.
So tell everybody what you did that year.
Well, even though for academic reasons I probably shouldn't have, I decided that I would go to every Virginia Tech football game. So in the 99 season, including the national championship game, I was there. A couple of real interesting stories from that year. It kind of small world stuff. I remember going to the Pitt game, which, of course, was close that year for me because I was in Carlisle. So you just jump on the Pennsylvania Turnpike and head down there. And I'd bought two tickets from the Tech ticket office. So I'm heading down the Pennsylvania Turnpike. I didn't end up having anybody to go with me, so I was going to try to sell a ticket. So I stop at a rest area there. It's probably an hour from Pittsburgh. And on the way out, on the way out of the bathroom was this Asian guy wearing a Virginia Tech shirt. And I said, hey, I just assumed. I said, hey, you going, you need a ticket? And he's like, yeah, I need a ticket. So we started up, we started talking. And he was a Tech grad, and he had been in the Marching Virginians. But this is the funny part. In Carlisle, Pennsylvania, there's one Chinese restaurant. It's called Dorothy's Chinese Kitchen. So whenever you wanted to go there, and I said, hey, I'm in law school and Carlisle, whatever. He's like, oh, yeah, Dorothy's my mom.
No kid.
So funny. He's from Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and Dorothy's Chinese Kitchen was his family restaurant, and I just happened to meet him there, and we sat together at the Pitt game, and it was the only game I saw in their old Pitt Stadium.
That was kind of a neat stadium.
It was
they just tore it down when they got.
I think it was the year after that. Yeah,
okay. Yeah. I mean, it was like built into the side of the hill, sort of. Yeah. Very cool. Very cool.
I believe they tore it down and built the Peterson Events Center where they play basketball now. I think the Peterson Events Center is on that land. But it was one of those deals where you'd go into the stadium, and underneath the seats was how do I put this? Just very primitive. You could see the concrete seats going up, and there was literally dirt underneath them.
Did you pay attention, like walking into Notre Dame Stadium? You could tell where the new concourse starts and the old concourse begins.
Yeah.
You see scenes from the movie Rudy when he's jogging and doing sprints in the concourse of the stadium. And now, since they expanded the stadium, you've got this new part on the outside, but that old stuff is still in there.
I thought they did. I was there both times we played, and I thought they did a good job between the two games. I liked what they had done.
Yeah. Notre Dame in the expansion of the stadium.
I remember being shocked the first time at the video board. I mean, 20 years behind even what we had. I mean, it was like, it looked like a Tecmo Bowl or something. I mean, it's,
there was nowhere to watch replays.
Exactly. So, I'm surprised. I mean, they had obviously been recruiting on name alone for a long time.
Yeah,
You can't do that anymore,
Yeah. And even they realize that. So during that 99 season, which road trip was the hardest? I mean,
I think definitely the one that the one I got the least sleep on was East Carolina. So it's a Thursday night game right down there. They were ranked. I think there was some hype. They thought they were going to beat our tails. They had that pretty good quarterback.
Was that 99?
Oh, that was 2000. That was about 2000.
Was that 2000?
Yep. Yeah.
David Garrard was their quarterback.
Right? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So,
I don't. Our game with them was home that year?
Let me look it up.
It was definitely a Vic game. I'm pretty sure we played down there in 99. Now maybe I'm.
No, it was 2000 Thursday night game in 2000.
Okay.
Because their fan base was so fired up.
So in 99,
Lee Suggs rushed for about 150 yards.
Well, that wasn't in 99. I went to that game too. I guess it was in 2000.
Right.
Yeah, Virginia Tech did not play East Carolina in the 99. Okay.
We played them to open the 98 season.
So which were the away games? Pitt, Rutgers, Temple, West Virginia.
Okay, the away games in order are UVA.
Yeah.
We beat them 31-7. Rutgers 58-20. Yeah. Pitt 30-17. The WVU game, of course, 62-7 at Temple, and then the national championship game.
Okay.
So Temple, if you went to the Temple game, that probably wasn't too bad. Well, that was the other side of the state.
Yeah, no, I went. I remember that was in the old Philadelphia's old stadium, which was a real dump.
Oh, the Veterans Field.
Yeah. And it was, I guess it was right after that when they built their new stadium.
That's right.
Temple started playing there. Yeah.
So the longest road trip you would have had was from Carlisle to Charlottesville. Wasn't that far away. Maybe Rutgers?
Yeah, and that was the reason I think I was able to do that. It was one of the years. You know, the way our schedule is, we always have Boston and Miami away in the same year.
Yeah.
Blacksburg was probably your longest trip.
The home games
was your longest
trip. Other than New Orleans, absolutely.
Because
they played at Pitt and at WVU, and that would have been fairly close to where you were.
You go through Pittsburgh from there.
Yeah. So I know Penn State's in the middle of the state. Where is Carlisle?
Carlisle is about 30 miles into Pennsylvania off Interstate 81.
Okay.
I mean, it's basically 4 hours north from Blacksburg if you speed.
Okay.
It's like right around Gettysburg.
It is.
Says the history major.
Exactly. It is. It's about 45 minutes from Gettysburg.
Yeah.
You keep going north another 20 miles, you get to Harrisburg.
Yeah. So you segued, turning back to the business, you segued into traffic defense. And at one point, I remember when you first started sponsoring Tech Sideline, I think at that point in time, you had three offices, Richmond, Roanoke, and Blacksburg. Does that sound right?
Probably at that time, something like that. Yeah.
But you said before, I think before we went live, that you eventually, at one point, had five offices around the state, right?
Correct. And it wasn't that long ago. Here's the interesting story about how I got into traffic defense. My would-be wife, Rhonda, was at that time doing her residency in a little town called Greencastle, Indiana, which is where DePaul University is. Potato vice president went there. He's like their famous alumnus, Quayle.
Quayle.
DePaul's game with somebody is one of the classic games. You know, they bring up every year. DePaul plays some other little school in Indiana, and they're talking about how it's one of the oldest rivalries or whatever. But so I was on my way up there. I had the way I would go, I'd go all the way across Kentucky and then up. You go north at Louisville.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I had just crossed into, I guess, Indiana going north, and I got nailed. I got pulled over.
The red lights went on. Blue lights, I guess.
Yeah, they threw the blue light on me, as my clients like to say.
Uh-huh.
So I got pulled over, and I got the speeding ticket, and then went on and visited my wife. And then I came home, and, you know, 3 days later or whatever, I get this letter in the mail that said, hey, I see you got a speeding ticket, and I can help you with that.
And you got it from an attorney.
In southern Indiana. And so I paid him, and he helped me, and I didn't get the ticket on my record. And at the time, I thought, can we market like that here in Virginia? And at that point, there was some direct mail marketing going on in Virginia for traffic, but really not any in the western part of the state. And I was kind of the first person to really, really aggressively use direct mail. And it's because it happened to me. So my wife takes all the credit, obviously, for me figuring this out, which is fine. But so that's kind of how I got into traffic, just by chance, by trying this marketing. And and having so much response because everyone knows Interstate 81 and 77 is heavily enforced if you live near here. I mean, shoot, it makes a bullseye in Wythe County, which at the time was pretty dead on. I mean, there were days in Wythe County back then where there were 2,000 traffic cases in on a docket. I mean, wow. It was crazy. So early on, with no one else hardly doing direct mail, I mean, the response was explosive. I mean, I was doing 50 consultations a day at one point.
Wow.
Just for speed related offenses.
Well, I know once upon a time, I don't remember when this was because I don't remember anything anymore, but I had some sort of traffic offense and I got a letter from the Fisher Law Firm offering to represent
me. I'm pretty sure that happened to me one time.
Yeah, I think you were too cheap to hire me though. I don't remember. But anyway.
Well.
Yeah. So that's kind of how I got into traffic. And what that allowed me to do was build this wealth of experience. I mean, at this point, even not my firm, but me personally, I've handled over 20,000 speed-related offenses. And
you personally have handled 20,000.
More than 10,000 reckless by speeds, which as far as I can tell is more than any person that's ever lived in this state.
In Virginia,
of course, reckless by speed doesn't really exist anywhere else. It's a unique thing to Virginia.
Is that right?
Very
so different. What are the rules? Let me tell you what I think are the rules on reckless, and you correct me if I'm wrong. It's 20 miles an hour over the speed limit.
Or 80 miles an hour.
Or 80 miles an hour regardless of speed limit. Is that correct?
Or more than 80. So 80 and a 70 is not, but 81 and a 70 is. Just 20 or more over or more than 80 in any zone.
So do the cops actually hand out reckless driving tickets for 81 and a 70? Do you see
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely. Not as much around here. Now, where that really happens in Virginia is down like on the 85 corridor, Greensville, Emporia, Brunswick, all that. I mean, you will see
that's
one after
words.
Another. We'll get calls one after another, 81, 81, 81. Now, around here, if you see 81 and a 70 in this part of the state, that raises a big flag. Because typically that means the person was a jerk to the cop. Because most of the time the cops are going to write you at 80 around here.
They're
going to give you a speeding ticket.
Where around here is a 70 mile an hour speed?
Most of 81.
Most of 81. Yeah.
Really?
I
thought it was 65 between here and Roanoke.
No, it's between here and Roanoke, it changes. There's the highway safety corridor that starts in northern Montgomery County and goes through, you know, basically until you get to Botetourt. It changes probably five times.
Yeah.
But for the most part, going south at 70, other than Carroll County, there's no 70 zone at all in Carroll County. It's all 65. So
weird. I just know I go down 77 a lot towards either Charlotte or I've got my middle son is going to South Carolina now. So I know that when you hit 81, it's 70 miles an hour down in that area.
In southern Wythe County, it becomes 65 and it remains 65 all the way to North Carolina.
Yeah.
So there's no 70 zone at all in Carroll. But anyway, so I kind of got into traffic and did all this. I got all this experience. But I remember I had one day, the green light or the light bulb moment for me was a day when I think I had, 60 cases in three counties between with Carroll and Smith. And most of the time at that point, you could kind of count on knowing what deal you were going to get. And it was very easy to do a high volume. But there's always in the back of your mind, there's always the potential for something to go wrong. I mean, if someone was really rude to the officer or whatever, they could block a deal like that. And I remember rolling into court and, thinking it was going to be a routine day as normal and having to try one of those cases because my client had not been polite. And not being prepared to do it because I had presumed.
Right.
At that point also, I was running myself physically to death. Okay.
Uh-huh.
So on the way home, I just remember thinking, who is this good for? You know, my client had just been convicted of reckless driving because I hadn't prepared.
Yikes.
Because I assumed. I was tired. I'm like, this isn't good for my clients. This isn't good for me. Who is it good for? And at that point, I slowly started the transition to where I am now.
Now, when would you say that was?
When?
Yeah.
Oh, that's probably 5 years ago.
Okay.
You know, and then I started this transition to personal attention, higher quality, lower volume. So I banked all that experience that I've gotten over the years, but now I use it more for I don't roll in with 30 files under my arm anymore,
Yeah.
You know, people hire me at this point who need it done the right way, and they need that experience, but they also want to, you know, I give my cell phone out to all my clients and I'm accessible and things like this. And I try to make that. And then, you know, now I'm kind of in the final phase of this. I still do a lot of reckless driving, but in the past 2 years, I've really transitioned over to a DUI heavy practice.
And so I want to get into that in a few minutes, but let's get back. Malcolm, how many minutes in are we? About an hour. Okay, so we got maybe 10 or 15 minutes left. So everybody on Facebook Live, tell me what your worst Virginia Tech football game is, and I will go first. Okay. 2010 Boise State. I thought about that. I knew we were going to cover this topic, and I was like, why was that the worst for me? If you remember, Chris, tell me if you remember exactly, I think Virginia Tech was ranked 7th in the country.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
And Boise was either third or fifth. Third.
I think third.
Wow. That's incredible. I tell people all the time, I hate Boise State. I don't hate Boise State. I'm jealous of Boise State because with fewer resources, they've had a lot of really, you know, remarkable moments in their past. Can't speak for now. They're still a good football team. But so it's 2010, and I've been doing this Hokie Central Tech sideline thing for 15 years, and I had started to detach and be more of an analyst and all that stuff. And frankly, the late 2000s were kind of rough. There was some bad offense, great defense, but bad offense. And I felt like looking at Virginia Tech's roster, particularly offensively, starting out the season ranked number 7 in the country, and looking at the schedule and thinking, if they win that game, they've got a shot at playing for a national championship.
Absolutely.
And I put on the fan hat big time for that game. And I remember driving up to FedEx Field and rented a Dodge Challenger, took my buddy James with me, James Arthur. And I remember sitting in traffic. I remember people telling me how cool the car was. I'm like, it's just a rental. A bunch of my college friends converged on FedEx for that game. And you go in there and it was 85,000 Hokie fans.
It was Lane Stadium plus 20,000 people, probably.
Yes, yeah. And the atmosphere was insane.
That's what I heard. I wasn't there, but
I wasn't there.
And it was and just the being down 17-0 5 minutes later. You know, I'm exaggerating, but and then coming back and then losing at the end like that. And I tell people all the time, I think I've written this, the ushers had to come by and tell me to leave the stadium. It's time for you to go. I was just sitting there just crushed. Mm-hmm. And that's probably the last time I really put on the fan hat big time. And so I've been around, and I also tell this story. I emceed some events for Bud Foster in the early to mid 2010s and was around some of the players that played in that game. And that game haunts them. The guys that played in it. So that's why for me it's my worst ever. So let's go to Jonathan now. What's your
okay? So I think the worst experience was a game I was not at. The ones that felt the worst for me where I was there in person was probably the Kansas Orange Bowl.
We were there 17-0 also.
Was it really?
Real quick. Jeez.
Yeah, that one and I lost. I was in the Carrier Dome for the McNabb moment.
Really?
And see, the Carrier Dome, it really is a pit of hell. I mean, I
until recently. Thank you, Mike Young.
Until Tuesday night.
Every time I was there, it was predictably the same thing. And here's the thing, too, and I don't want to offend anyone here that may be listening, but upstate New York people are not necessarily nice, okay? And so, and also a lot of Syracuse fans are not Syracuse alum. I mean, in fact, most of them are. I mean, that's a
and
small.
And those fans tend to be the worst.
It's a small, pretty relatively small private school, whatever. So, and they sold alcohol through the end of the third quarter. So it was predictably the same. You could just see it coming like a tidal wave. Everybody, you know, I'm sitting with a bunch of Syracuse fans.
A bunch of jerks with beer.
Yeah, right. Well,
and they're coming back to win late.
Initially, we're winning, okay? So, you know, they're relatively polite, drinking, you know, polite, this and that. And then you feel it. You feel it coming. As the intoxication level grows, they're coming back. you know, culminating in, you know, the 50-yard run followed by the vomiting and then the throwback pass across the field.
Donovan McNair vomiting, not Jonathan.
I mean, at that point...
He didn't throw up till afterwards.
I mean, I was... At that point, I was nursing a broken leg I was recovering from. I was seriously lucky to get out of there alive without being killed. I mean,
I'm sorry to laugh. I mean,
but it's like in... Like the intoxication and just all of it, right, culminating in that pass.
If you had started your business at that point, you could have just handed out business cards.
Yeah. So that was pretty gut wrenching. The most disappointing one was the Kansas game. Disappointing because I really thought we should have won, and because I never understood. We came out in the second half and handed the ball off, what, 11 times and scored, and then we quit running. And I never understood that.
Or they was could... suspended for the first half of that game, remember?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but they. But I mean, I'm not a football coach, but they could not stop us.
Right.
And then we quit doing it. So anyway, but the one that disgusts me is Michigan. I mean, I absolutely – that's the only game where I anymore – I will actually be awake at night thinking about it and be disgusted. not just because of the catch that we were robbed on that everyone knows about, but, you know, just the way that game went down. I mean, we held them to, what, 160 yards? And that running quarterback, what's his name? It was
Denard
so good.
Robinson.
Denard Robinson.
That one really – but and because the other reason is because it kind of was the shifting point. I mean, we had got obliterated by
Clemson.
By Clemson the week before. We still, because of our travel rep and ranking, made that game, and then we, you know, pooped the bed on that one, and it was kind of the beginning of the end of the fun.
We've only had one 10-win you know. Season since.
And then TSL changed its message board format
and
6 days
later. Everything
went
downhill,
And all hell broke loose.
But anyway.
So what about for you, Chris, and then we'll get to Facebook.
I would say that Boise State game also. That's the only time in my life I've thrown my cell phone.
You've done what?
That's the only time in my life I've thrown my cell phone across a room.
Whoa. Yeah. So where you weren't up there? You
I was at a bar.
I was mad.
Wow.
I was on Myrtle Beach on vacation.
Yeah. Wow. So, Malcolm, what does Facebook Live say about their worst game ever? I bet that Kansas game is on there a lot.
The 2007 Boston College game is up there several times.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh. Because of the rain. Yeah, fair. It was nasty.
Cincinnati game, obviously. Which Syracuse game? Well, the 95.
Okay. Syracuse game with McNabb, right?
2006 Chick-fil-A Bowl versus Georgia.
That was disgusting, too. That was almost as bad as Michigan.
But it's a lot of the 2010 JMU loss.
You know what?
That's a fluke, so it doesn't count.
I just considered that.
It does count.
That was our second loss of the season to Boise State, as far as I was concerned.
Exactly.
Dale Kizer, battle at Bristol because he paid $1,200 for two
tickets.
Oh,
my gosh.
And then we lost.
Wow. Was Dale on the Virginia Tech sideline for $600 a ticket? Because none of those tickets were all that close.
That one's up there, though. You remember we went to that?
Yeah. So were you a senior in high school?
I think so. And then everybody ran out of ice, and a buddy of mine lost his phone on one of their transport buses.
Yeah.
That was rough.
I remember that was a pretty slick operation.
It was an interesting experience. I was in, I bought a seat in a box, in a inside seat, but for whatever reason, I had asked which side the Tech fans would be on, I was told, and then it was wrong. So we're like, Rhonda and I are the only two Tech fans in a whole suite full of Tennessee fans because I was on the wrong side. But anyways, the food was good. It was fun.
Yeah.
And they were less obnoxious than my normal Tennessee experience. It was maybe it was the I don't want to be a classist here, but maybe it was the who it was in the box. I don't know what it was, but I do remember that one thing that was funny because any girl who knows about Tennessee girls, you go. My wife said she went into the bathroom there. There was like 5 complimentary cans of hairspray in the suite bathroom, you know, because the Tennessee girls all have the hair.
That's hilarious.
You know?
I love the account Super 70 Sports on Twitter. And every now and then he'll post this picture of these 80s chicks with the hair, and the caption is "Rest in peace, ozone layer."
Yeah,
2 million years ago to 1987.
Well, the Tennessee ladies still do that. So anyway.
Yeah, if you're not following Super 70s Sports on Twitter, you really need to. Some of their stuff is hilarious, and we've talked about them before. So let's finish up talking about where your business is now and what you're doing.
Let me interject. If I'm piecing comments together, I think the Chinese guy you gave a ticket to, Eric Fisher, was his roommate in college. And I think he just hit him up and he commented, the Chinese friend from Carlisle says hi, but he's in a meeting right now and can't jump onto the feed. He never put it together. That's you who gave him the ticket.
That's funny.
Oh, that's very cool.
Yeah, it is cool. I hope Dorothy's okay. I don't know if mom's still doing well. I have fond memories. Yeah, I'd love to talk to him one day about that game. It was a lot of fun.
And of course, Eric will tell him that he can watch it archived on YouTube later.
Yeah.
So that's very cool.
It is. Small world.
Anything else really cool that you want to do before we get back into?
A long time ago, you mentioned the Cincinnati game, 95. The attendance for that was 36,000, and
so I thought mid 30s probably. I bet it wasn't that many. That was probably paid.
Yeah, that's incredible.
And I bet that, you know, by the end of the game, I bet it was closer to 15.
So who looked that up for us?
Not me.
Oh, okay.
Imagine he's doing his job.
Man, he's really grown into that producer role, man.
And then next week we played Miami and the attendance was 51,000. So
yeah, which is pretty much capacity. Yeah,
it was two rows from the top in that game.
Yeah, wow. So tell us about your business, what you're doing now, how people can get in touch with you, and all that. Sure. So you got 5 minutes, sell yourself.
Okay. I've really changed, and I'm in the process of changing what I do. And over the last few years, I put a lot of time and a lot of energy, a lot of money, and a lot of hours into the DUI-specific training. I really wanted to get out of the high-volume speeding stuff, although I still do that, and I still help a lot of old clients. And
Like if I got a speeding ticket, you'd represent
absolutely,
me.
Absolutely. I still do that. And a lot of reckless by speed. I mean, by volume, so many of those are handed out. It's, you know, it's the gift that keeps giving from a business standpoint. And because of, there's a pretty solid lobby in the legislature. I mean, they talk about changing that law or changing it from 81 to 90 constantly, and it gets shot down because too many people are making money, both the counties and the defense bar. So anyway, I'll continue to do that, I'm sure. But I've really kind of turned my focus more into DUI and or substance-related crimes.
When you say DUI, that does include something other than alcohol, really?
Sure, yeah. Sure. I mean, there, you know, you can be charged with driving under the influence of drugs as well. And those are different cases and cases where you really do need a DUI specialist, because those are cases that involve blood draws and not breath machines. So it's a completely different animal there. Yeah. So, but, you know, people sometimes will say to me, how can you defend those people? You know, drunk drivers, this and that. DUI is a crime that's really, really changed over the last 50 years. You know, I'll talk to my older friends, older attorneys who practiced a lot in the 70s. One thing then, I mean, I think at one point the 0.08 limit was as high as 0.15.
It was 0.15 when I was a young person.
And then it went to 0.10, and then it went to 0.08.
By the way, 0.15 is hammered drunk.
Oh, it is. Yeah. Very drunk. But back then, a lot of times, you know, you get pulled over, you'd be wasted. You know, the cop in the 70s, 60s, 70s, they'd slap you on the back, call you, give you a ride home.
Yeah.
Whatever. Yep. And then in the 80s, everything changed because of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I mean, I think the perception of DUIs prior to that as a joke was incorrect, and a lot of people were dying then. I think the numbers are way down as far as fatalities. And Mothers Against Drunk Driving really is responsible for that, and I commend that. I'm not pro drinking and driving. I want to make
clear, no one on this set is in favor of drinking and driving.
Exactly. And I do think at some point, I'm convinced that technology will eliminate the crime. I mean, I think there's going to be a point where you know, you're going to have to touch something with your thumb and it'll be able to tell if you got alcohol in your system, the car won't start. Something's going to happen. It will eliminate drunk driving. But I'm not pro drunk driving, but I am pro people getting an appropriate defense for it. Yeah. And believe it or not, some people charge a lot more than you would think. People charged with that crime are innocent of it.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people have alcohol in their system but aren't impaired or aren't over the limit, and they still get arrested. But one thing, I want people to understand who it is that's getting charged with DUIs, because people have this perception, again, you know, from TV or publicity or whatever. I looked it up once, and throughout the course of a year, 80% of my first offense DUI clients were people who had never been in trouble before at all. And when I say never, a lot of them had never even had a speeding ticket before, okay? Yeah. And almost all of those people I never hear from again, at least not for anything serious. So what
because they don't do stuff like that
again. That's right. What I discovered, you know, and again, as I discussed earlier, I defended all sorts of criminals early in my career, and a lot of them, okay? So I've seen violent criminals. I've seen, you know, people who steal and, you know, hurt people. I've seen people with a lot of character flaws, just inherent bad people. And what I discovered is that these first offense DUI folks were not exhibiting bad character. It almost always was a judgment error. And the problem with it's kind of a, you know, alcohol is a catch-22. I mean, you got a good person, and then they drink, and then they're impaired, and the beverage makes you make poor decisions.
Yeah.
So it almost causes the judgment error that leads to the, you know, to them being stopped in the DUI. So these are not ogres, okay? These are your kids here at Virginia Tech. This is, you know, I represented someone, who had never been in trouble, and, you know, who was almost 70 years old. Wow. Really well-respected member of the community, you know. These are good people who made a mistake. And then there is the group that I do represent as well that are repeat offenders, okay? But what you got to understand about those people is almost all the time those also are not bad people. Those are usually people who really have substance problems. Yeah. I mean, they have addiction problems. And they're struggling, and there's almost always, I mean, people out there know there's almost always a backstory to that stuff, okay? These are folks who really need help. What's funny is I don't necessarily see a whole bunch of overlap between, people who in their lives they've been convicted of rape, assault and battery, and then they get DUIs too. I don't see that much, to be honest with you. Yeah. It's almost always other people, either good people or people who really need help.
Yeah.
So anyway, as far as my practice, I want to help this group of people. In addition to helping them with their offenses, I want to make sure that these people get on with their lives if it's a first offense and get over that obstacle. Or if it's someone who has a repeat offense problem and they have substance issues, I want to not only help them with their legal problem, but try to guide them to some help, because if they don't get the help, they're just going to end up back in jail, killing somebody on the road, or hurting themselves.
And a lot of people don't even know what resources are available.
That's right. I mean, some of us take it for granted, you know, but I mean, everybody kind of knows about AA or this and that. But, you know, these issues are complicated, especially with repeat offenders, because almost always there's an underlying psychological issue there too. And, and they're trying to medicate that issue. And in order to ever solve your alcohol or substance problem, you got to figure out how to solve your depression problem or whatever else it is, or you're just not going to get better. Yeah. And you're going to reoffend, and you're going to end up in a worse spot. So, you know, I have some experience with that in my family, you know, of addiction, of alcoholism. I know a little bit about that, and I want to not only help them with their legal issue, but just help them. You know, my job is to improve their life, their situation as well, not just solve this problem. Yeah. And I get a lot of fulfillment from that. So,
what sets you apart from other? You know, let's focus on the DUI part.
I'll call a timeout right quick.
Yeah, you need to go to the bathroom?
Yes. That's fine.
All right, we're going to let Chris go.
I realize it's time to wind down here, but a couple of things.
Chris was looking twitchy there. I wondered what it was. All right.
Well, a couple of things. The training, I mean, the time that I put into it.
Yeah.
And I really want to be able to put more time into it. And the more I get away from a volume practice, the more time I'll have when I'm not in court doing a DUI, the more time I'll have to learn about helping those folks. But, you definitely want, people need to understand, I think, that DUI is different than a lot of other criminal charges in that some of it's the preparation's the same, but some of it's different. There's a scientific aspect to it and a completely technical side that's not related, not the same as with other charges. And there's no substitution for experience in that regard. So,
and so you will go anywhere in the state.
I do. Again, I do have an office here in Blacksburg. I'm toying with the idea of not even having a physical office anymore. The Commonwealth of Virginia and the courts are my office basically at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, in the last month, I've appeared in Henrico, Spotsylvania, Bristol, Prince William. I have a felony pending on the Eastern Shore right now. Wow. And then, of course, still Roanoke, Montgomery, lots of stuff around here as well, of course. Yeah. But I enjoy that. I enjoy that. And you know, I'll come to you. You know, I'll come to where your offense is. I do think that there's some advantages sometimes to having local counsel, but I've found that it's not, it doesn't make up for knowing what you're doing when it right, comes to DUIs. Right. You're better off having a DUI specialist than you are having whoever, you know, there in town.
All right. So how can people get in touch with you?
Well, I mean, if you're a Tech Sideline person, then obviously you've probably seen my banner. So you can go to fisherlegal.com. You can shout at me in response to a message on the football board. You know, you can email me or go to my website. It has all the contact info, though.
Right. And he posts as VPI 98 on our message boards. Right. So thank you for coming in and talking Hokie sports with us. We were feeling lonely with only two of the seats full the last couple podcasts.
It was really fun.
So thanks for coming in and thanks for sponsoring the website years.
It's been my pleasure.
5 or 6 years straight. All right, everybody who hung with us on Facebook Live and has listened or watched elsewhere, we really appreciate you being with us. And I guess we'll do another one of these next Monday. I do not think Evan will be back yet, so I'll complain again about having to prepare and all that good stuff. So thanks for being with us, and thanks for Jonathan Fisher, and we'll see you again soon.
Thank you.